Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hi, everybody. We begin this week with President Obama's newest offer to Republicans to make a deal on the deficit, offering a reduction in Social Security cost of living adjustments in exchange for more tax revenues. Liberals like Bernie Sanders and Robert Reich are organizing against the idea, but don't worry, John Boehner and the Republicans are rejecting it anyway. Hence the piece by Washington Post Wonk Blog author and MSNBC contributor Ezra Klein titled "The Strange Alliance Between John Boehner and Liberals." Ezra Klein joins us now as our first guest this week to talk about that and more. Hi, Ezra. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Want to start by describing this strange alliance?
Sure. So there has been a repeated pattern in the president's negotiations with John Boehner. And you saw it very clearly in 2011 on the debt ceiling when President Obama and Boehner had that long set of negotiations behind closed doors. It ended with Boehner walking away from a deal that would have had, depending on who you believe, roughly $1 trillion in tax increases for increasing the eligibility age for Medicare, for cutting Social Security benefits, for making very, very deep cuts in other kinds of spending. You're seeing something somewhat similar now. And you saw it again in the fiscal cliff, where, again, a lot of Democrats weren't all that happy with where the negotiations appeared to be going. But in each case, what's been really fascinating about how they've ended up is that President Obama is clearly willing to take deals that liberals just find unconscionable, particularly when it comes to raising the Medicare eligibility age, cutting Social Security, putting a lot of the entitlement programs on the table. The person who won't take that deal, the person who simply refuses the president's efforts on this, is John Boehner. And so there's been a fascinating little pattern here where the president makes offers that many conservatives think are not bad offers and that liberals think are terrible offers. And John Boehner is the one over and over again who saves the liberals, but in doing so, does so in a way that puts the blame on Scott Schneider. Deal on the Republicans. So liberals kind of get the two things they want. The deal isn't done and they didn't like the deal, and the Republican Party ends up getting the blame for the deal not getting done as opposed to them. So it's been, for liberals, the alliance with John Boehner has been relatively profitable so far.
So listeners, you want to call in on the strange alliance between John Boehner and liberals, as our guest Ezra Klein describes it, or any other questions or comments on this apparent offer from the president to do away with so-called chain CPI for cost of living adjustments on Social Security, and anything else on this, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And our brand new, fresh from Monday morning comments page is just sitting there waiting for you to fire it up. So go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show and start the parallel conversation there. But again, on the air, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Ezra, this term still makes a lot of people's eyes roll. So can you give us your best progressive budget wonk's definition of chain CPI and what it means to seniors, potentially, that President Obama would be willing to compromise on its use?
All right. Well, look, I'm not going to answer for progressives here. I can just answer for me.
Okay.
Chain CPI, the best way to put this is it is a change to the way the government measures inflation. Now that gets that sounds very boring, very complicated. But what's interesting about it is it's basically a trick. So what's happening right now is we use one measure of inflation, and that decides how quickly Social Security benefits increase. It decides how quickly people move from one tax bracket to another. If we change that measure of inflation to one that moves more slowly, which chain CPI does, then Social Security benefits don't go up as quickly. More people move up in tax brackets as they make more money. And politicians get to say, and here's where the trick comes in, they get to say, we didn't cut anything. We didn't raise anybody's taxes. We just made a technical fix to the way the government measures inflation. And who could be against a technical fix? In fact, who can even understand a technical fix? And so what you said right there, Brian, is really important. One of the reasons chain CPI is a very popular cut in Washington is it is so boring. and the name of it is so weird and complicated that people just kind of tune it out. And the best way to make a spending cut, if you're an elected official, is to make a spending cut that nobody can understand,
right,
because then it's harder for them to attack it.
So that's on one level. On another level, many other budget wonks say that chain CPI is actually not the best way to spend taxpayer dollars because it overestimates the actual inflation that seniors tend to face in their lives. So the president decides rationally in this scenario that that is a place to save money on senior entitlements. Do you dispute that assertion?
I think that the simple question people should ask here is not to get into really thick debates about what is the proper measure of inflation. I really don't believe that that is a reasonable that is the important question here. There's a simple question. Do you think that we should slow cost of living increases in Social Security? Do you think that people should be moving into higher tax brackets more quickly? Those are the actual questions. In anything, we are dealing with a question of what our priorities as a country should be. And in fact, something that I try to argue a lot is that we get into trouble, I think, because we have this preference in Washington for these highly technical cuts. There are probably, in my view, if you want to cut Social Security, better ways to do it that are more straightforward than something like chain CPI. There are ways to do it that protect the very poor more effectively. There are ways to do it that probably raise more money in more appropriate fashions. And similarly, people love to talk about raising the retirement age because, again, they just say, oh, it's a technical thing. People are living longer. But that is simply a regressive cut to benefits. Again, there are better ways to cut either Medicare or Social Security.
Well, what?
So I think that people shouldn't get overly trapped in the technical thickets here. Just
decide well, if what, want what to might be an alternative, you know, that you're referring to there? Because to push back on your premise, if, for example, chain CPI was giving seniors on Social Security a 10% a year cost of living increase, and I know that's, you know, way exaggerated, but just so the numbers are clear as a hypothetical, let's say it was 10% a year they were getting, but real inflation that affects their lives is only 5% a year. Why do we just look past that question altogether rather than ask it and come up with a number that actually reflects inflation?
Let me just correct one. So chain CPI would be the thing we were moving to. The current thing is just normal CPI. So we'd be moving to chain CPI and pulling it back. But look, your question is a fair one. If we're measuring inflation wrong, why not fix it? I think the answer here a little bit is that we don't really know if we're measuring inflation wrong, particularly for seniors. They have a very different basket of goods they pick up than other people do. There's really interesting, I think they're interesting anyway, arguments about in the literature about how to measure inflation for seniors. And by the way, Peter Orszag, the former Obama budget director, points out in Bloomberg View today, chain CPI has been increasing more the difference between current inflation and the chained inflation measure we're talking about has narrowed in recent years to rather than 25 or 30 basis points, only 10. If that remains true, then the difference between chain CPI and normal inflation will be much, much lower. But that said, again, I think that we need to my issue with this, and I'm not, by the way, against cutting Medicare or cutting Social Security. I think there are a lot of ways to do it that make sense. I'm much more comfortable with means testing than a lot of people in Washington are, and also with increasing the taxes on them. But I do think that we should be able to have a discussion that's simply about how much money do we want to save and how do we want to save it. I think that one trick Washington is playing, and I find it, you know, as somebody who is sort of on the wonky side of these discussions, not just a little bit offensive, but deeply undemocratic, is to hide the cuts they're doing in thickets of complexity that people can't follow. And I think when you do that, you don't just lock people out of a process that they need to have a real voice in. The other thing you do, and I think this is important, is that you end up having to choose cuts that are dictated by their complexity as opposed to how good they are at cutting the thing you're actually doing. So rather than doing something like there's a change you can make in Social Security to the preliminary insurance amount formula, which would be a more progressive way to do it but is in certain ways easier to understand, you end up in these things like chain CPI, which I just don't think are ideal ways to cut it. And by the way, I think the same about raising the retirement age, which I think is actually one of the absolute worst ways you can possibly cut Social Security or change Medicare in the whole bucket of things we could do.
Andrew Klein, my guest on WNYC, Washington Post columnist. Find his stuff most easily at their Wonk blog. And he's an MSNBC contributor. And 212-433-WNYC, our phone number, as we talk about President Obama's latest offer having to do with chain CPI and Social Security to the Republicans. towards some kind of a deficit bargain. Giovanni in Bed-Stuy, you're on WNYC. Hello, Giovanni.
Good morning. The issue I have with this whole thing is that I am a senior citizen. I'm also a retired math teacher and science teacher. And as I look at this whole thing, we shouldn't be thinking about minimizing CPI. We should be thinking about maximizing it, simply because the Social Security system is so efficient, and it produces year in and year out surpluses that build up the trust fund. Now, the truth of the matter is, no matter how much what you do to make cuts in Social Security, it's not going to affect the budget or the deficit, because the money that there's two different tranches of money that go into accumulating revenue for this country. Hello?
Yes, we're still listening. It sounded like you were heading toward the end of a sentence.
Yeah, a whole lot of revenue. And the revenue that goes to Social Security comes from a flat tax capped at $100,000 that produces surpluses.
Right.
So what if you cut revenue? What if you cut Social Security? And where's that money going to go?
Giovanni, I appreciate the point, and I'm going to ask Ezra Klein about it. Thank you very much. So, Ezra, let me put his point to you as a question this way. Do you reject the generally accepted premise about Social Security, that even though it has always generated a surplus until now, as the caller says, the curve is such that with so many boomers and life expectancy rising and the number of workers to retirees, the ratio at historic lows, that the program does actually need to save or collect more money to stay solvent over the next decades?
No, I don't. I disagree with the caller on this. In the next decade or two decades, I don't have the exact projected date in my back pocket, the trust fund is going to run out, and Social Security will bring in significantly less than it's paying out. Now, the way the law works right now, the argument that Social Security doesn't relate to the deficit goes like this. It's a closed program, so in theory, it's being paid for entirely through payroll taxes, which are levied up to about $110,000 of income. When it doesn't, when those payroll taxes and the trust fund they're currently paying into, because they are at the moment generating surpluses or have been in recent years, when that runs out, the way the law is structured is that Social Security benefits are automatically cut by whatever the amount of the shortfall is. So it doesn't add to the deficit because we are assuming that at that point, you know, we will begin cutting Social Security checks by 10%, eventually by 20%, by 30% from where we expect them to be now. Nobody anticipates we will actually do that. I don't believe we will actually do that. I don't believe we should do that. But I don't. I also don't believe this idea that Social Security exists in some sort of truly separate part of the budget. To me, you know, and we get into wonky stuff here. You know, I believe the budget is all one thing. I believe in unified budget accounting. You know, if we want Social Security to be funded in part by general revenues, which, by the way, when we've had this payroll tax cut in place over the last couple of years, we don't have it now, of course, that was how we filled that hole, right? We filled it out of general fund revenues. I think it's a more progressive way to fund Social Security. I think this whole thing where we've segregated that and Medicare off from the budget has mostly just confused people. But either way you look at it, if you're saying that Social Security on its present level does not contribute to the budget or the budget deficit and also does not need any changes, then what you are saying is that you expect to follow massive, massive Social Security cuts in the coming decades. And I don't think most of the people making that argument actually do intend to see those cuts happen.
And some stats that may be relevant to how this all affects people in their real lives when they are on Social Security, rather than some of the more abstract ideas we've been discussing. I saw that Bernie Sanders was tweeting over the weekend, at Sen Sanders, against this change. His stats were that the average Social Security recipient gets only $14,000 a year to begin with, and two-thirds of seniors rely on Social Security for more than half their income. Now, that's a lot of data to squash into 140 characters, but it also shows the kind of low-income nature of this whole conversation about Social Security.
And I think one thing that's really important to bring into this as well is that the rest of America's retirement system, what we used to call the three-legged stool of retirements, which are Social Security, employer pensions, and private savings, the other two legs are in much worse shape, frankly, than Social Security. Employer pensions have moved from defined benefit pensions, which 40% of private sector workers had 40 years ago, now only about 15% do, to defined contribution like 401ks, what I have, for instance, which went from about 15% 40 years ago to about 40-some now. The 401ks are, on average, horribly underfunded. People approaching retirement right now typically have, you know, or often have less than $30,000 in them. That's not nearly enough to retire on. Private savings don't look good either. You know, we have a real retirement problem in this country. We talk about Social Security's problems because we're on the public balance sheet. But if we're not going to have a really sharp fall in the standards of living, in the standard of living for seniors who are retiring in the coming decades, we're actually going to need to figure out a way not just to deal with Social Security shortfall, but actually somehow add more retirement resources to the system. That's not an easy conversation to have and not one people like to have, but it's nevertheless true. I mean, if you look at the rest of the retirement system, things look pretty grim, and not because we have too much money going to retirement, but because given the number of people retiring and given, you know, what their needs will be like, we actually have too little.
I think it's a really great point, and I saw that you had written that up in a separate post on Friday on Wonk Blog, I think it's one we can't emphasize enough, that Social Security has problems, but the other traditional two legs of the three-legged retirement stool are the ones that are really in crisis. Employer-funded, retirement from work, like you say, 401ks, and the other tranche, is that what they say in the financial world?
Right.
Of personal savings that it is so hard for people to stash away these days, or that our culture has led them to stash away less of. Helen in Mayopac, you're on WNYC with Ezra Klein from The Washington Post. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. So I have some expertise in price measurement, and I don't disagree with many of the things that Mr. Klein has said, but I do disagree with the use of the chain CPI as being a trick. It is not a trick. The premise of it, and it's really not that complicated, is that when prices change, people adjust their spending. So if the price of Granny Smith apples goes up and the price of Red Delicious apples go down, people will buy more Red Delicious apples and fewer Granny Smith apples. That's the general idea. Now, the evidence in the economic literature and the economic research, including researchers by the Bureau of Labor Statistics who produced the CPI, is that people's behavior actually does adjust when relative prices change. And so the CPI, the chain CPI, is a more accurate measure of inflation than the one that is currently in use. And it is better to use a more accurate measure for the purpose of escalating for inflation. Now, if we're worried about poor people, we need to take care of them in another way, but not use a less accurate measure of inflation to be able to take care of the poor. So that's my point.
Thank you. Ezra?
I think the caller is exactly right. And her point about the chain CPI is about trying to account for the substitution effect is right on as well. I'm trying to align some of that just for this, so I don't destroy your ratings here today, Brian. But that's all correct. You know, my point
We have a very wonk-tolerant listenership, but go ahead.
My point when I say it's a trick is not the chain CPI is itself, although I want to say that there is very reasonable disagreement in literature about whether it or another measure of inflation would be the right way to understand the substitution effect. My point is that the reason chain CPI is in the conversation, the only reason it is there, is not to get a better measurement of inflation. There's a reason it's part of the budget deficit negotiations, right? It is there because it is considered a palatable cut to Social Security. And by the way, not for nothing, a palatable way to increase taxes. About a third of its deficit reduction would come from increasing taxes, which is something that Democrats tend to like more. My point is that if what we want to do is get $300 billion or $250 billion, depending on how you construct it, of deficit reduction, then I think we should just ask how to do that in the way that makes the most sense, both from a distributional and an efficiency standpoint. The reason people like chain CPI in Washington is because it is complicated enough that other people don't understand it, they don't understand that it is a cut, and who will see a problem for it. That's why I say it's a trick on the part of politicians. But there's a real methodological issue that that the caller points out here. That part isn't a trick. I just don't like to see people getting locked out of the process because politicians are purposefully overcomplicating it so that the rest of the country can follow what they're doing.
So let me ask you one more political question before you go, and back to your idea of this strange alliance between liberals and John Boehner. Things like this change in Social Security, cost of inflation or cost of living adjustments that liberals don't like, Boehner goes ahead and rejects, not on their behalf, but it winds up saving the programs that they like. The Boehner rejectionism may get broken up by Republican pressure. Here is 45 seconds of Senator Lindsey Graham yesterday on Meet the Press.
There are nuggets of his budget that I think are optimistic. It's overall a bad plan for the economy. But when you look at chain CPI and Medicare reductions, we're beginning to set the stage for the grand bargain. Change CPI, adjust, harmonize the retirement age of Medicare with Social Security, do some means testing for both programs, and in return, flatten the tax code, generate about $600 billion of revenue. And if you look at these changes over 30 years, it's $4 to $5 trillion in savings. So I'm looking for the biggest spending cut in American history by reforming entitlements, saving those entitlements, and the president's showing a little bit of leg here. This is somewhat encouraging. His overall budget's not going to make it, but he has sort of made a step forward in the entitlement reform process that would allow a guy like me to begin to talk about flattening the tax code and generating more revenue.
So Lindsey Graham saying the president is showing a little leg. Interesting choice of words. I don't know if that's the moral equivalent of the president talking about how attractive a state attorney general is. But what did you think about that, Ezra? And we just have a minute left.
This is exactly the White House's plan right now. If you note, on the night of the budget, they're having dinner. President Obama's having dinner with, I think, about a dozen Republican senators. This Wednesday night. They don't believe they can make a deal with Speaker John Boehner anymore. They think that ship has long since sailed. What they do hope is they can break off, you know, 5, 10, 15 more moderate Senate Republicans into a larger deal, and that if that deal passes Senate with their support, with some bipartisan support, that Boehner, who in his heart of hearts most people think is not that opposed to a deal, will let it come to a vote in the House, and then it will be passed by one of these coalitions of a lot of House Democrats and a number of House Republicans, possibly even a minority of House Republicans. But that quote from Lindsey Graham, that is exactly the White House's hope. If they're going to have a deal, if there's any way for them to get a deal, it is by showing enough goodwill towards Senate Republicans that they get a couple of them broken off so they can get it through the Senate and then move it to the House on that basis.
Washington Post columnist and Wonk blog author and MSNBC contributor Ezra Klein, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, mayoral hopeful Bill Thompson. Stay with us.